It's a story that's in three parts. The first part is called John the Son, Loving the God Given Him. And the second part is about the father of this boy, John. John is about 15 in the story. And the second part is called Life of John's Father, Another Place Ending. And the third part is about his mother, the mother of John, searching. So it's a three-part story, and I think that's significant in the John, the son, and the mother, and the father. The triune God is what comes to mind, sort of. Entertaining God being the name of the story, entertaining is ambiguous in its use in this title. It could mean entertaining like hosting. You know, you entertain friends. It could mean entertaining like amusing. I'm putting on a show for God, or I'm amusing God. Or it could mean entertaining like considering the thought of God. I'm entertaining God in my mind. I'm thinking about God. And I think it probably works on some level all in all three of those. Maybe others that didn't occur to me, but certainly in those three ways. In part one, when it's titled John the Son, Loving the God Given Him, lots of questions come to mind just right away. Who gave him this God? What do you mean, giving the God given him? What kind of a God is given to him? What are we talking about here? We understand that John is acting out a love for this God, loving the God, but we don't understand much more than that. So I think it's good to keep those things in mind when you hear the story, because it'll help you sort through what's happening as I'm reading it. So with those words, I'll start. Part one, John the Son, Loving the God Given Him. The name of the story is Entertaining God. Tell you that much.
Okay, you mentioned it and we're there.
Okay, good. John the Son, loving the God given him. The boy huffed and puffed and swatted flies as he climbed the hill, pulling on the rope. He stumbled on the uneven ground, a pile of grit and gravel collected in the toe of his shoe. He could not stop to empty out his shoe, nor could he stop to rest, because he did not have the time. It was getting late in the afternoon, and there was a chance the gorilla would be missed. He hoped he would not be missed, at least until tomorrow, which would give him time. He jerked on the rope. He would have to reach the top of the high hill very soon, or the gorilla was going to fall down and go to sleep right where he was. "Come on," he said encouragingly to the gorilla, who looked at him with dreamy yellow eyes. He had been talking to him soothingly all the way, but the gorilla was drowsy from the medication the zookeepers had given him and did not reply except to grunt sluggishly deep in his throat. He hoped to have better luck with him when he woke up tomorrow. All around them now were trees and grass and vines, and he hoped the scenery was pleasing to the gorilla. It was pleasing to him, and he was himself a person who did not need trees and grass and vines. There was a faint drone from the direction of the highway as cars whizzed to and fro around the outer edges of the zoo. They sounded, he thought, like wasps or big flies as he swatted at the gnats that were hanging around his face. Behind him, he felt a tugging on the rope as the gorilla cleared the air in front of his face, too, but with a sluggish, petulant swipe, and his black plastic eyelids had started to droop. The boy leading the gorilla was young and very lean, with exceptionally black skin that seemed to curve light around his bones. The skin of his face was stretched taut by the pointed severity of his cheeks, and this flattened his nose, which was broad and rounded at the tip. There was a wistful gentleness in his face, an effortless grace in the erect way he held his head. It was not apparent in his stride what he had suffered. Those first days at the zoo, when he stood crying in front of the gorilla cage, had left no lines of agony on his face. the hour of his deliverance was not stamped forever on his forehead. When he embraced the God that others, his mother, had chosen for him. The boy tugged hard at the rope. They were going over a big lump of ground that was half-submerged rock. The gorilla stopped abruptly, sniffed resentfully at the boy, and without further notice sat down on the ground. The boy pulled the rope once more, but the gorilla didn't budge, and instead stretched himself out sullenly and fell asleep. Soon he began to snore, which caused the boy to stand over him and look wonderingly into his open mouth. It was deep rose and pink inside, trimmed in black like a pretty cave. His big swooping teeth were like yellowed icicles and rusty stalagmites. There was a sturdy bush nearby to which the boy fastened the end of the rope, looking back momentarily at the mouth. Then he raked together leaves and grass and branches to make the place where they would spend their night more comfortable. Then he took from under his shirt half a loaf of rye bread and a small bottle half full of red wine. He laid them carefully underneath the bush around which he had tied the rope. Then he left the gorilla sleeping as he walked away from their campsite to try to figure out where they were. They were still within the grounds of the Bronx Zoo. That much he knew, for they had not yet come up against the high fence that surrounded the zoo. However, it was not his intention to get outside the zoo, so this did not bother him. He hoped that if the zookeepers missed the gorilla before nightfall, they would think he had been taken out of the area, for that would keep them safe until he had got what he wanted from the gorilla, and the gorilla would have received the kind of homage he deserved from him. He satisfied himself that he would be able to spot searchers if they started up the hill toward them. There were trees and shrubs and vines and large boulders, and if necessary, and if he could arouse the gorilla, they could move about and lose anyone who came after them. But for the present, he was not worried, for he did not expect the gorilla to be missed until feeding time tomorrow, and by then, everything would be over. The boy walked back to the gorilla and sat down on the grass. Dusk had begun to fall when he made his survey, and now it was quite dark. Like a drunken old man, the gorilla snorted and grumbled in his sleep. The boy supposed it was the medicine. Every year about this time, the gorillas in the zoo got a dose of something to protect them from diseases, and it doped them up for a couple of days. That was how he'd been able to get this one out of his cage without bringing down the whole zoo. Gorillas could be noisy when alert. The boy smiled down at the black hulk of fur next to him. He looked in awe at the size of this beautiful animal. Gently, he rubbed the gorilla across the back of the neck, and the gorilla snorted and then sighed in complete comfort and abandonment like a huge, sleepy baby. The boy stretched out next to him, laughing out loud. Soon he fell asleep, and as the air got cooler toward the middle of the night, he snuggled closer and closer to the clean, warm fur of the big ape. He slept dreamlessly and greeted the slow, windless dawn with keen anticipation. The gorilla was still asleep, but less peacefully now. The boy thought the medicine must be just about worn off. He looked on the lump of ground over the head of the gorilla. He stood on the lump of ground over the head of the gorilla and looked in the direction of the zoo building and of the building from which he had taken the gorilla. All was quiet. The forest all around was still. He listened intently, waiting. Soon the birds began to chirp, and the wind stirred, moving the leaves. The very air seemed alive. It was like singing or flying, and the boy felt exhilarated. He stretched his hands above his head as high as they would go as he greeted the sun, which rose in slow, distant majesty across a misty sky, nudging clouds gently as it made its way. The boy stared straight at the sun through the mists, delighted at the sunlight spots that stayed in his head and danced before his eyes. The gorilla began to grunt and rake his blunt claws against the ground. The boy watched him with eyes shining with great pride. He turned away as the gorilla sat up and began picking at his coat and proceeded to gather small twigs and moss with which to start a fire. The gorilla sat upright, grumpily watching and picking at his hide, his bleary eyes clearing gradually like the sky. He sniffed the air, looked around him at the forest, looked in stupid bewilderment at the open sky, which extended on in blueness the further back he reared his head. He rolled his giant head round on his neck as if chasing away the remains of a headache. He pressed lightly against the place on his buttocks where the big hypo had gone in. He grunted loudly and impatiently. He was hungry. The boy went about building the fire with slow ritualistic movements, his black hands caressing the wood, the leaves, his warm breath moving the fine feathery dryness of the moss. His wide bottom lip hung open in concentration. From time to time he looked up at the gorilla and smiled burstingly in suppressed jubilation. Soon the small fire was blazing. The boy sat back from it and looked at the gorilla. He smiled. The gorilla grunted. He turned distrustingly away from the fire and then turned back to it as the boy went over to the bush, took the bag with the bread in it, and walked back toward the fire. The gorilla began to fret and strain against his rope. He smelled the bread as it came from the wrapper and made a move toward it. The rope drew him up short. "Just you wait a minute, you," the boy said softly, and gingerly held the bread over the flame. In a second, he leaped up as if he had forgotten something important. He put the bread down and untied the gorilla. He led him to the shallow rise overlooking the fire and gently pushed him down. The gorilla, as if still doped and continually wringing his head on his neck, sat tamely. The boy resumed his toasting of the bread. As each piece of bread was thoroughly blackened, he dropped it into the flames. Then, as the bread burned, he bowed all the way down to the ground in front of the gorilla, who sat like a hairy, mystified Buddha on the shallow ledge, his greedy eyes wide in awe of the flames. Each time the boy took out a new piece of bread from the bag and the odor of rye reached him, the gorilla made a move forward, slowly and hopelessly, like a turtle. The boy kept toasting the bread and then dropping it into the fire and then bowing his head to the ground. The gorilla watched. The boy mumbled all the while. When he got to the last piece of bread, he halted in his prayers and reached behind him for the wine. He opened the bottle, and the scent, like roses and vinegar, wafted up in the air and reached the gorilla, who became thoroughly awake for the first time. The boy bowed his dark woolly head to the ground once more, mumble, 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 and then toasted the end piece of bread. Then, holding the bread in his hand, burned to a crisp, he poured the half bottle of wine into the fire. The gorilla, who had watched everything as if spellbound, gave a gruff howl of fierce disapproval. With his back to the sodden embers, the boy bowed on his knees, still mumbling his long, fervent prayer. On his knees, he dragged his body up to the gorilla's feet. The gorilla's feet were black and rough like his own, with long, scaly toes and straight silken hair on top that was not like his. Reverently, he lay the burnt offering at the feet of his savage idol. And the gorilla's feet, powerful and large and twitching with impatience, were the last things he saw before he was hurled out of the violent jungle of the world into nothingness and a blinding light. And the gorilla, snorting with disgust, grabbed the bread. That's part one. Part two, the life of John's father, another place ending. The boy was John in part one. John's father had heard that in the last miserable second, your whole life passed before your eyes. But he and the plain black girl who was his second wife moved into the moment itself with few reflections to spare. When they heard the twister coming, like 20 wild trains slamming through the houses on their block, she grabbed the baby and he the small boy, and hardly noticing that the other moved, each ran toward the refrigerator, frantically pulling out the meager dishes of food, flinging a half-empty carton of milk across the room, and making a place where the vegetables and fruits should have been for the two children to crouch. With no tears, no warnings, no goodbyes, They slammed the door. Minutes after the cyclone had leveled the street to the ground, searchers would come and find the children still huddled inside the refrigerator. Almost dead, cold, the baby crying and gasping for air, the small boy numb with horror and with chill. They would peer out, not into the familiar shabby kitchen, but into an open field. Perhaps the church or the Red Cross or a kind neighbor would take them in, bed them down among other children similarly lost. And in 20 years, the plain black girl and the man who was their father would be forgotten, recalled, if even briefly, by sudden forceful enclosures in damp and chilly places. This, too, the future passed before his eyes, the father's eyes, and not one past life, but two. He wondered in that moment only fleetingly if the God he'd sworn to serve, and of his wife he now held in his arms, and thought instead of his first wife, the librarian, and of their son, John. He had married his first wife in a gigantic two-ring ceremony in a church. Excuse me. And his wife had had the wedding pictures touched up so that he did not resemble himself. In the pictures, his skin was olive brown and smooth, when in fact it was black and stubbly and rough. He had married his wife because she was light and loose and fun, and because she had long red hair. After they were married, she stopped dyeing it and let it grow out black. Then, with the black, unimaginative hair and the discreet black patent leather shoes she wore, the gray suits she seemed to love, the continual poking into books, well, she was just no longer anyone he recognized. After he quit the post office, he became a hairdresser. He liked being around women, old women with three chins who wanted blue or purple hair, young tacky girls who adored the way platinum sparkled against black skin, even stolid, reserved librarians like his wife, who never seemed to want anything but a continuation of the way they were. Women like his wife intrigued him because the duller he could make them look, the more respectable they felt, and the better they liked it. But living with his wife was more difficult than straightening her hair every 2 weeks. He could conquer the kinks in her hair, but her body and mind became rapidly harder to penetrate. He found the struggle humiliating besides. John, unfortunately, had been too small to hold his interest, which was not to acknowledge lack of love, simply lack of interest. The plain black girl he married next was a sister in the nation and would not agree to go away with him except to some forsaken place where they could preach the word to those of their people who had formerly floundered without it. He too changed his name and took an X. He was not comfortable with the X, however, because he began to feel each morning that the day before he had not existed. When his anxiety did not subside, his wife claimed an inability to comprehend the persistent stubbornness of his agony. He knew what it was, of course. Without a last name, John would never be able to find him. He had seen his boy John once in 10 years, when John was almost 15 years old. He had been eager to talk to John, eager to please. John was eager to get away from him. Not from dislike or out of anger, that was clear. John did not blame his father for deserting him, at least that's what he said. No, John simply wanted to get up to the Bronx Zoo before it closed. "John, I don't understand it," he had shouted, annoyed to find himself in competition with a zoo. His son watched his lips move with a curious interest, as if he could not possibly hear the words coming out. John looked at his father with impatience and pity, and with an expression faintly contemptuous, superior. It unnerved the father, for it was the way John himself had been looked at when he was a baby. For John had all the physical characteristics that in the Western world are scorned. John looked like his father, an honest black. His forehead sloped backward from the bridge of his eyes. His nose was flat, his mouth too wide. John's mother was always fussing over John, but hated him because he looked like his father instead of like her. She blamed her husband for what he had done to John. Yet he was John's father. Why shouldn't the boy resemble him? The father's new wife loved him fiercely with a kind of passionate abstraction, as if he were a painting or a wondrous sculpture. She wore his color and the construction of his features like a badge. She saw him as a king returning to his lands and was bitterly proud of whatever their two bodies produced. In the South, in a hate-filled state, complete with magnolias, tornadoes, and broken-tongued field hands, they had settled down to raise a family of their own. The minds of their people were as harsh and flat as the land and had little time to absorb a new religion more dangerous than the old. Still, they had persisted, and in the struggle he had found peace for himself. It was true that he was lost to John, but through the years his wife helped him see that John was really just a cipher, one of the millions who needed the truth their religion could bring. He had finally accepted himself, but it seemed that in the moment the beauty of this acceptance was most clear, he must say goodbye to it. A sound like 20 wild trains rushed through the street. They moved as one person will move, their children in their arms toward the refrigerator. They threw out the food, crammed the children in. They slammed the refrigerator door and rushed, like children themselves, into each other's arms. Part 3. The Mother of John, Searching. Of course, John's mother was much older than the other black radical poets. Remember, she's the one that was the librarian and quit dyeing her hair red and wore gray clothes. John's mother was much older than the other black radical poets. She was in her 40s, and most of them were in their 20s or early 30s. She looked young, though, and engaged in the same kind of inflammatory rhetoric they did. She became very popular on the circuit because she said pithy, pungent, unexpected things. And because she undermined the other poets in hilarious and harmless ways. Students who heard her read almost always laughed loudly and raised their fists and stomped and yelled, "Right on!" This was extremely gratifying to her because she wanted more than anything in the world a rapport with people younger than herself. This is not to suggest she used the Black Revolution to bridge the generation gap, but rather that she found it the ideal vehicle with which to vindicate herself from former ways of error. No, she had not, as several of the other poets claimed, truly believed in nonviolence or in Martin Luther King. She had found King's Southern accent offensive and his Christian calling ludicrous. Nor had she ever worked as a token Negro in a white-owned corporation. She had never attended an interracial affair at which she was the only black, and it went without saying that all of her love affairs had been correct. On the other hand, her marriage to a lower echelon post office functionary, who, though black, indeed was not suited for her temperamentally, foundered for many years, and shortly after the birth of a son was completely submerged. And though she was heard from coast to coast blasting the genteel Southern college she had attended for stunting her revolutionary growth and encouraging her incipient whiteness, and striking out at black preachers, teachers, and leaders for being eunuchs, Oreos, and fruits, it was actually the son of her unsuccessful marriage that lent fire to her poetic deliveries. He was never mentioned, of course, and none of the students to whom she lectured and read her poetry knew of his existence. He had been dead for 3 or 4 years before she even began to think of writing poetry. Before that time, she had been assistant librarian at the Carver branch of the Municipal Library of New York City. Her son had died at the age of 15 under rather peculiar circumstances. After removing a large and ferocious gorilla from its cage in the Bronx Zoo, only his mother had been able to piece together the details of his death. She did not like to talk about it, however, and spent 2 months in a sanitarium afterward, tying a knot over and over in one of her nylons to make a small boy's stocking cap. A year after she was released from the sanitarium, she cut her hair, discarded her high-heeled patents for sandals and boots, and bought her first pair of large hoop earrings for $1.50. A short time later, she bought a dozen yards of African print material and made herself several bright nunnish dresses. And in a bout of agony one day, she drew small, elaborate sacrification marks down her cheeks. She also tried going without a bra, but since she was well-built with good-sized breasts, going braless caused backache, and she had to give it up. She did, however, throw away her girdle for good. She might have been a spectacularly striking figure, with her cropped, fluffy hair and her tall, statuesque body. Her skin was good, and surprisingly, the sacrification marks played up the noble severity of her cheekbones. But her eyes were too small and tended to glint, giving her a suspicious, beady-eyed look, the look of pouncing, of grabbing hold. The students, who applauded so actively during her readings, almost never stopped to talk afterwards with her. And even after standing ovations, she left the lecture halls unescorted, for even the department heads who invited her found a reason usually to slip out and away minutes before she brought her delivery to a close. She received all payments for her readings in the mail. And sometimes, after she'd watched the students turn and go outside, laughing and joking among themselves, puffing out their chests in the new proud blackness and identification with their beauty her poetry had given them, she leaned against the lectern and put her hands up to her eyes, feeling a weakness in her legs and an ache in her throat. And at these times, she almost always saw her son sitting in one of the back rows in front of her, his hands folded in his lap, his eyes bright with enthusiasm for her teachings, his thin young back straight. She had renamed him Jomo after his death. Softly, she would call to him, "John? John? Jomo?" And though he never answered her, he would amble down to the lectern and stand waiting while she gathered up her notes, her poems, her clippings from the newspaper, her voluminous collection of the errors of others. He would wait for her to wipe her eyes, and then he would go with her as far as the door. Entertaining God. So the first section was John the Son loving the God given him. And the second section was the life of John's father, another place, ending. And the third section was the mother of John searching. Isn't it? Alice is saying, it's strange, it's strange. It is pretty strange. I think it probably hangs together. It certainly is compelling when you read it. I mean, I think it is something pretty strong about it. So what do you think about God? Who is this God that we're entertaining? Do you have hazard a guess on that?
What was the title again?
Entertaining God. And I mentioned at the beginning that entertaining, I saw used in at least three senses in the title. One is entertaining in the sense of hosting, you know, the way you'd entertain your friends. And the second is entertaining in the sense of amusing God, doing something to put on a show for God. And the third is entertaining in the sense of considering the idea of God, thinking about God. And I think maybe the word is deliberately ambiguous. It can go all of those ways. On the literal level, who is God in this thing? Who does John, the boy, the 15-year-old boy, treat as a God?
The gorilla.
The gorilla. And he makes a sacrifice of the rye bread, half a loaf, and the half a bottle of wine. I wonder why a half loaf and a half a bottle of wine. I found myself just writing question after question after I read it a few times. Why this? Why that? Why that?
So he was the rest of the sacrifice.
There you go. And he's only 15. He's sort of half of a person, too.
Half grown.
Half grown, yeah. How old was Jesus? 32?
It's like he experienced a transformation, though, after the sacrifice. You know, the way it ends, that first part, he's into the white light. You know, it's like the fire is a transformation. That symbol came through to me as a fire.
Mm-hmm.
The sacrifice of himself.
And then he entered the white light.
Mm-hmm.
Which we all probably would if we were hurled through the air by a gorilla.
Yeah.
And just before that, Alice Walker makes the point that his feet look like the gorilla's feet.
So he obviously identified with that gorilla.
Yeah, and he describes his experience. Remember when his father came to visit him for the first time in 10 years and he wouldn't stay and talk to his father because he had to get up to the zoo before it closed? And then there's all this talk about his experience standing outside the gorilla's cage at the zoo. There's a paragraph about it. There was a wistful gentleness in his face, which we think of as Jesus. An effortless grace in the erect way he held his head. It was not apparent in his stride what he had suffered. Those first days at the zoo, when he stood crying in front of the gorilla cage, had left no lines of agony on his face. The hour of his deliverance was not stamped forever on his forehead, when he embraced the God that others, his mother, had chosen for him.
Oh, I missed that the first time through.
It's hard to fit it in, and partly because you don't know the mother at that point. But the mother, it's interesting the work that the parents are assigned. The father starts out as a post office functionary and becomes a hairdresser and is quite taken with the surface of appearance. I mean, he's turned off by his wife because she stops dyeing her hair. And he's into appearance and intrigued by it and delighted by it. And his own appearance is a real, what she calls a real black, which is high cheekbones, forehead slanting back, and very broad nose and wide mouth. Flat, broad nose. So that's the father. And then the mother's work is first as librarian, with always having her nose in a book. And so presumably acquiring knowledge, acquiring masses of information. But the mother is transformed, gets out of her gray suit and black patent leather shoes into a nunnish costume, makes herself nunnish dresses, but colorful with African prints. Yeah, and starts and has a natural hairdo and becomes a poet, and becoming a poet is certainly becoming a seer or a visionary or a, you know.
Do you get that she did that before John's death or
no,
after?
3 years after.
After.
After, 3 years after, okay.
So his death made her crazy.
Oh,
that's right.
Yeah,
she's a sanitarian. That's right. I forgot that. Well, she rejected him. Before that, she rejected him
because
he looked like her his father.
Yeah.
So all his features, you know, he was obviously rejected by his mother earlier.
Yeah.
So what God did his mother choose for him? That's what I'm trying to think.
Mm-hmm. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm. As I think about him standing in front of the cage crying, if we make him sort of a symbol of Jesus, I think of Jesus looking at humans who are imprisoned.
Mm-hmm.
And here he freed and gave his life because he had freed the gorilla.
Mm-hmm. And very early in the description of his taking the gorilla up the hill, it says that there's trees and grass and vines, even, it says. And it says, of course, he doesn't need those things, but the gorilla needs them. John is only human, and the gorilla has need of those things.
So in one respect, the gorilla could be symbolic for humankind. And in another sense, it sounds like he worships the gorilla. So the gorilla is
He's the ideal, maybe, for him. What he would like to be, free, and the features are the same as his. Somehow freeing himself through freeing the gorilla.
And see, the mother gave identity later, much later, when she became a poet, to all these students who gave who Black pride. I mean, they would walk out of the auditorium after they had heard her with their chests puffed out, and they felt good about themselves as Black people. And so she had some pithy, as I said, some kind of wise remarks or inspiring remarks after her transformation. And while she was in the sanitarium, she was tying a knot over and over in one of her nylons to make a small boy's stocking cap. And one of her nylons is the nearest thing you can come to your own skin. I mean, if she was trying to create something for her small boy, and it wasn't for a big boy, and by then, of course, when John died, he was 15, which is practically fully grown. Why was she trying to create a stocking cap out of her own skin?
She rejected him always when he was little.
One of the things, I remember having a friend who had very curly hair, and he didn't like it, and he always wore something over his head at night so that it flattened out his curly hair.
Oh,
so
that's a good point.
Maybe she had put a nylon stocking.
An awful lot of Black folks do that.
To straighten out the hair and don't push it down.
Yeah. That's a good point, because a lot of people do that.
But see, that would tie in with her having rejected some of his Blackness, of saying maybe she had made him wear nylon in his head every night, so his hair was flat.
Yeah. Where I was sort of going with the gorilla thing in my own mind, making the gorilla a god was making his Blackness, some attributes of his physical appearance, the surface attributes of being Black, a god.
His hair was smooth and silky, is it?
Yeah.
But the only way the mother would have given it to him is if he is rebelling against the fact that she rejected his Blackness.
Yeah.
Because the mother rejected his Blackness.
Yeah. So it doesn't hang together, it doesn't...
Well, unless, you know, a teenager is rebellious and will do what you tell them not to do. So maybe in some perverse way,
he was
honoring himself and the Blackness of himself.
Yeah. He wasn't drawn to his father.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out how the father fit in all of this.
And the death of the
father. And the girl's hair was smooth. I wonder if that remains.
Yeah, I think all that hair stuff does have something to do with it. I mean, they talk about the mother's hair too. Her hair fluffy
and
her cropped fluffy hair. I left a word out because I didn't know how to pronounce it. Describing her hair as a librarian, it's chignon. What's that word?
Yeah. Figure eight.
So it was a year after she was released from the sanitarium, she cut her chignoned hair, discarded her high heeled pattens for sandals and boots.
So she would have previously been trying to fit into the white culture.
It's really smooth hair to make a chignon.
Really?
Very smooth, yeah.
Huh.
And I think of it severe, just pulled straight back real tight. And so she went from red, fluffy, to so she had three transformations in the course of the story.
You're right. That's interesting. And at first, she was described as being real light and fun mm-hmm. when he was courting her. And then she became this severe librarian.
Maybe that's what the god, the gorilla, kind of represents the conflict she had, you know, between the smooth hair and the, you know, the black facial features. Maybe that's what it means, what the mother gave him, this god, this conflict between the two, you know, which is good. Is black good, or is this smooth hair?
And the gorilla's got both.
Yeah, so it kind of is a symbol of that conflict in her life.
Well, that's good. That's interesting. Because they make a point of saying that the gorilla's hair and his foot, although the foot is like the boy's, the hair is smooth and silky, which is not like the boy.
And the mother in her middle phase had the smooth pulled back hair.
Yeah, and she made that cap out of a nylon stocking for him. Which gives the mother some of the attributes of the father, because we think the father is the one who was the beauty parlor guy and interested in the appearances.
When Deanne Lockquist did that on that one black lady last week, do you remember the name of? Did you go to that one?
I don't think so.
Well, it was later on. It was a black lady, but anyway, one of the things we read from her writings, she gave us pieces to read. And this lady wrote about how when you grew up black, it seemed like the important things were hair and lips and something else.
Polly
Murray, that's what I was trying to think of. But that as a child, these things were so important in your household, you got a disproportionate view of those things.
When you're black.
When you're
that's
black,
when
yeah.
That's what your focus is. Uh-huh.
How light your skin is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's too bad we don't have a black person.
There are several poems about that, that black women have written about their appearance and talk about all those things. And this other poem of Gwendolyn Brooks is about a boy, and it's about the same thing. It's about his physical attributes as a black child.
What strikes me in thinking about the differences in the hair of the gorilla is like and unlike. The boy, that's the same language in Genesis when God creates male and female. That, the translations were crummy in English. I think I'm getting this right. But when the woman is described as the helpmate, what's really underneath that is she is like and unlike the male. And so together they've got this wholeness. I don't know where that goes in that, but it just is an image that struck me that maybe in the gorilla there was some sense of pulling, excuse me.
Oh, the boy embracing the contrary.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that somewhere before. And I also kept thinking, now, is this John the Baptist, who is the, he's called John, and, you know, the
I wondered why John.
Mm-hmm.
It's a Jesus figure.
Mm-hmm.
But then she changes his name. Yeah.
To Jomo.
And I would love to know what
that is. Which might mean just an African kind of name, maybe.
After
John
he's dead.
John is real waspy, you know, almost. White angles. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Why do you think there's a part about the tornado and the refrigerator and that kind of thing?
Yeah, the refrigerator. Right.
And that story is told twice. In here. And it is the focus of the story about the man, the father. Mm-hmm. And the father's part two. And the whole focus is the father's tried to make contact with John and failed. John's not interested. And then that he has a new plain black wife and these two little kids. And they live in a dingy house, and a tornado comes.
She wants to go to Africa. Africa's hot, the refrigerator's cold. They're very black, the refrigerator's white.
Weren't they living in the south?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, doing some kind of work for Malcolm X.
Right, yeah. Doing working as Muslims. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't comfortable with taking X for his last name because he was thinking that John would never be able to find him, mm-hmm. losing his last name. And they were not very effective missionaries because the people around them had two hard lives. They couldn't think about a new religion in the midst of their hard lives. And the son looked at the father, during the meeting, the son looked at the father with the same contemptuous look that the father used to look at the son with when he was a baby. Looked at his father with impatience and pity and with an expression faintly contemptuous and superior. It unnerved him, the father, for it was the way John himself had been looked at when he was a baby. Meaning because John had all the physical characteristics that in the Western world are scorned. John looked like his father. So the reason the baby was treated contemptuously is because of his appearance. An honest black.
But they must be in New York, at the Bronx Zoo, but it doesn't say there. It doesn't say they're missionaries somewhere else. How does that...
The father evidently traveled to New York to visit John for this visit. We don't get all that background. But it does say that after he reflects on his son John, then while he's dying, while his life is flashing before his eyes, then it gets back to the present and says, in the South, in a hate-filled state, complete with magnolias, tornadoes, and broken-tongued field hands, they had settled down to raise a family of their own. The minds of their people were as harsh and flat as the land and had little time to absorb a new religion more dangerous than the old. It was true that he was lost to John, but through the years his wife helped him to see that John was really just a cipher, one of the millions who needed the truth their religion could bring. He had finally accepted himself. The father had finally accepted himself, which implied losing John. Accepting himself as X. But it seemed that in the moment of the beauty of this acceptance, in the moment the beauty of this acceptance was most clear, he must say goodbye to it. Because that was all in the death moment.
No. It's interesting that John then becomes a cipher in that acceptance. The superficiality reigns. When he meets with John, the father seems to really believe that John held no bitterness. Because that's what he said. And in the end, John's still the cipher, of someone just needing to be saved.
One more of a million people with no special significance.
I don't think I know what a cipher means here.
A cipher. Isn't a cipher like an apostrophe? A little mark? Well, decipher means to figure out or understand. Well, we don't know what a cipher means for sure, but I think it means a little
black mark
like millions of others somehow. We will have to look it up. So then he accepts himself, he gives up his son, and he dies.
Not knowing his son is already dead.
Evidently, right. So what is the role of this father? Why do we even have him in here? It sounds like the whole thing's about his mother. His mother gave him his God. His mother went through these three transformations. The father went through two, at least, transformations in job, in his employment, and then he went through two families. And he lost his kids. Oh, no, he didn't lose his kids. He lost his own life.
How did they get in the refrigerator again? They weren't put in there.
Yeah. The children were put in there by the parents.
So they were trying to murder the children?
No.
Save them.
I missed that.
They heard the... here, I'll read the short version of it.
Save the tornado.
A sound like 20 trains rushed through the street, which meant the tornado was coming down the street. They moved as one person will move, their children in their arms, towards the refrigerator. They threw out the food, crammed the children in. They slammed the refrigerator door and rushed, like children themselves, into each other's arms. It's much sadder the first time it's told. It says...
that must be something that they need to do if you live maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you live...
If you live in a tornado country and you want to save your children...
Refrigerator. I think that's right.
The choice would work. Yeah. The alternative.
What a choice.
And they didn't have time, evidently, even to unplug the refrigerator, but the tornado took care of that.
Yes.
Yeah. When the children were found, the refrigerator was in the yard. But what it did say was that the children did not have a chance to say, I mean, they didn't have a chance to say anything to the children, so it was a total mystery to the kids why this was happening to them, which was sort of heartbreaking. With no tears, no warnings, no goodbyes, they slammed the door. And then just minutes later, minutes after the cyclone had leveled the street to the ground, searchers would come and find the children still huddled inside the refrigerator. Almost dead, cold, the baby crying and gasping for air, the small boy numb with horror and with chill. They would peer out not into the familiar shabby kitchen, but into an open field. And then later, and then it says that, and in 20 years, the plain black girl and the man who was their father would be forgotten, recalled, if even briefly, by sudden, forceful enclosures in damp and chilly places. Walk into the walk-in in the kitchen here, and all of a sudden they would remember this experience.
Seems that the father is a really negative figure for both John and his wife. You know, as soon as they get married, she, of course, it's her choice apparently to not have her fluffy, crazy hair anymore. I'm thinking of comparing him and some of the men in The Color Purple. I wonder if Alice Walker is
men
saying anything about
men. Really.
In
stories,
most
of the powerful people are
in. Yeah, I've been just immersed in her short stories for the last few days, trying to choose which one to read. And boy, some of the men are really the pits. I mean, they're cruel and mean, and they rape their daughters and kill their daughters and kill their wives. And, you know, there's a lot of rough stuff in there. And they're indifferent husbands and cold and... There's one. The one I almost read was about abortion. A woman who'd gone through one abortion before they were legal, and another one. Her husband wanted her to have an abortion, and she did after they were legal. And the husband was a real obnoxious, cold.
But you don't get that.
No,
he was,
I mean,
ineffectual, though. He was. Mm-hmm.
He was disinterested.
Yeah,
and not to be disinterested.
And he sort of was a symbol for the black, because he was the honest black, wasn't he? He had the features.
That's kind of what I got out of him. This was really simple compared to all the rest of you. But here's this child, totally mixed up, because his parents kind of rejected the black nation. And he was thrown out in this field, and that he grew up to be an honest black, but he was thoroughly confused. So he took this gorilla and sacrificed himself, and then threw him, the father and the mother, through her mental illness and their transformation, came back to their black religion, their black way of life.
Wow, that's not so simple.
Ooh. Well, it's way off from the rest of you have been talking
No,
about.
But it's fascinating. It's a really interesting thought. The father reacted so immediately, but so did the mother, the plain black girl, to the threat of death for their offspring, and they managed to save their offspring.
Mm-hmm.
So the father came through in the end, in that he saved his kids, or one of them. His wife saved the other one. And the mother certainly had a better, I think would you be fair to say she sounded like she was in a better place toward the end, although her life wasn't heaven. But in terms of her own acceptance of herself and happiness and resources in her life, it was better, I think, to be a successful poet than to be a sort of unhappy librarian.
But she went back to, she wore the prints and, you know, became the black image.
Mm-hmm. But only
of her native land, you know, not of America, but of the, I took it, you know, like the way they lived in Africa with their dress and...
Of her roots.
Of her roots.
Mm-hmm. But only after breaking down
right.
of the mental hospital experience. Mm-hmm.
So, like you said originally, he was sort of a Jesus salvation figure for Boy.
A rebirth experience mm-hmm.
for
death mm-hmm. of a sort and rebirth.
He saved.
And then why does she rename him after he's dead, and why does he visit her after he's dead?
Joma, the
African name.
An African name.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it has any meaning yet.
I bet it does.
I mean, you know.
I bet it does.
It's probably a charm, I would guess. Mm-hmm. It might be sort of symbolic of Jesus' return after his resurrection, too. The time mm-hmm. he came back and walked with the people again.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of a hopeful note, also sort of a resurrection.
Yeah. Well, he came back to
it. Maybe, in a way, you know, that the hope that you're talking about is sort of personified in his returning there.
He was sort of an item of faith in her head at that point, because it was said that her reading and her poetry was totally given fire by him. Mm-hmm. And meaning by him, and yet no one knew, none of her fans, none of her audiences knew of his existence. And for some, there was something about her that people didn't like, so they wouldn't wait afterwards. They would try to get away from her. And she was so lonely and isolated, but her boy would wait with her and be with her at those times of her performances, of her poetry, but only would walk her to the door. Which was, I would have liked it if I'd been she, if he would have come out the door with me.
Well, in a way, she's got some peace with him. You know, she's gone through that torment of maybe guilt or something after his death, the breakdown, and now his coming back represents some reconciliation with him.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, since he doesn't go beyond the door, I don't know what that means.
But since she's
significant still... of being in the refrigerator.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's another closed door.
It might mean that she's not completely happy with herself still. You know, she's doing this and doing this poetry and giving these presentations, and that's what she wants to do, and that's, you know, acknowledging the blackness. But yet, she hasn't been able to really make that complete transformation in her personal life or something, because mm-hmm. he doesn't go past the door.
And he's still a fantasy, you know. I mean, at least that's how I heard it. Jomo's still a fantasy in the back.
Right.
Oh, you know, yeah.
Sure.
And he doesn't talk.
And in her loneliness, in her, you know, her eyes, how do they describe that? You know.
Her eyes are too small and they're glinty.
Yeah, and her eyes being tired after her reading or whatever
mm-hmm.
that was. And Jomo's her fantasy, she calls out to him.
Yeah,
it's not really there.
Well, I mean,
she's
who are we to say?
Well, yeah.
I have a friend whose son died when he was young, and he mm-hmm. comes to visit her every so often, yeah. and it's as matter of fact as it can be.
Yeah.
She's not crazy.
Is that comforting to her?
Yeah.
I wonder?
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
Yeah. So the reality of dreams.
It's his spirit is very comforting to her. And I had the same sense that there was a spirit that was present there. But the boy then is meeting his mother's needs. And it's interesting that he would choose to after not having had a particularly wonderful childhood with her. Yeah. And it's interesting, it indicates to me that there's an ongoing relationship if you would bother to rename someone after they're dead. Your relationship with them is still
right.
evolving.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it symbolizes a different relationship.
Mm-hmm. Now, who was it? Simon Peter was. It's mm-hmm. not. There was no John in the Bible that went through that renaming thing. So that doesn't.
But Jacob was renamed. I mean, there are lots of renamings in Scripture after some sort of encounter.
Yeah,
Sarah.
So it is a biblical root there to rename.
May have something to do with new birth. I mean, it is a new life that you
didn't take on a meaning. And his death was experienced as meeting a white light.
And that you hear very often, too.
Yes.
People who are at death's door, they have a vision of light.
Right. Just a couple of years ago, my Uncle Jake, who says he'll never be afraid of death. Mm-hmm. You know, he's looking forward to it. Went through the tunnel.
Yeah.
And Uncle Jake is not given to that kind of talk.
Very persuasive, huh?
Yes. He's a football coach.
Oh.
So, I was persuaded.
Does she use the Christian themes in other stories?
Usually it keeps them at a... I mean, she plays with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, here she plays with it. Mm-hmm. And she calls the mother a nun, essentially. I mean, she says she several bright nunnish dresses, and she made these sacrification marks on her cheeks, which is a African religious, not a Christian thing. I don't know what the roots of that faith are, but it's something else. But she does like spirituality and religiousness, and she doesn't just use Christian images, but she uses a variety of kinds of images.
Well, and the color purple is Dear God, letters to God.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. That's right. And this one is called Entertaining God. I mean, she's...
Yeah, I wonder, you know, if it could be... I don't know if she really thinks highly of God after reading this or not. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. But there could be Muslim images. There could be African national images that we're not...
We don't know about.
We don't know about that.
I suspect that's true.
Yeah, that are in that.
Spirituality is a lot more universal in literature than just, quote, Christianity. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The symbols of salvation are universal.
Mm-hmm.
What do you use for Christian expression?
I think that this story feels to me optimistic. It feels
really
to me.
Is. It didn't sound too much like that when you start. I mean,
no.
It sounded depressing.
Yeah. But I think there is some real positive movement in all three main characters' lives. You know, and so, and she, I think she brings us to an understanding of their having a future and they're having hope and they're having transformation in a pretty way that you can feel it in your gut. I think it rings true. Well, thank you. The bell has rung.
Thank you.
This was helpful.
We would have never figured that out if we hadn't all been here.
We need each other.
It just occurred to me, wasn't the guy who was the liberator of Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta? I was thinking of him.
Yes.
Jomo.
That's right. That's right.
Well, another thing, it starts with the death of the boy and ends with his resurrection, in a way.
Boy, that's true.
Which is more symbolic.
It starts with, and it tells the story of his death, almost like the story of Jesus' death is told over time. It doesn't just happen, but it occurs in a context. Yeah.
I always think about the idea that some anthropologists say that what you say about discovered and digs and things like that, it says more about us than it says about people that